Over the past 30 years, the melting of the sea ice around the North Pole has exposed more than 1 million square miles of ocean for both research and commerce. On the first of today's underreported segments, Mackenzie Funk explains how the world's nations are scrambling to get control of both. His article, called The Arctic Land Grab, appears in the May issue of National Geographic. It's also Natural. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
The last time you were on this show was in 2007. You spoke to us from an Alaskan icebreaker. Was that trip part of your reporting for this article?
Yeah, it was. It was actually the main event of the reporting for this, and I was about a month on the Healy, which is the U.S., well, the one working of the three U.S. icebreakers.
Five countries are involved in the land grab, aren't they? U.S., Canada, Russia, Denmark, which controls Greenland, and Norway. On what grounds do they make their claims?
They make their claims on basically the undersea extent of the continent that extends into the Arctic Ocean. And it's under the UN Law of the Sea, which allows everyone to basically extend their borders, their maritime boundaries, based on how far it basically looks like North America or Asia extends underwater before it drops off into oceanic floor.
And are they pretty much cooperating these days?
Well, it's interesting. There's you know, the land grab thing for, well, first of all, it's not quite land, it's seafloor, but there is a lot of cooperation because it's as helpful to them to work together on some of these matters as it is to battle over it, just because they, first of all, there aren't enough icebreakers to go around, and second of all, they need to agree on the basic boundaries before each can make their claim.
Well, some have wider borders with the polar area, the Arctic. I would think Canada and Russia would have the most land to get, wouldn't they?
Yeah, you're very right. Each country can basically draw out its borders just from, we already have 200 nautical miles off of all the coasts. So what this is about is the upper part of the Arctic. So beyond those 200 nautical miles, and of course Russia has the hugest swath. They have once tried to lay claim to 45% of the Arctic Ocean, and Canada is thought to be the next biggest, though they haven't tried to submit a claim yet. The next one actually may be Denmark or Greenland, and the U.S. has a pretty small portion, as does Norway.
Because we just have Alaska.
Exactly.
Russia planted a flag in the Arctic Ocean floor at the North Pole in 2007. Is that a symbolic claim, or does that have some legality?
Well, that was very symbolic, and unless things break down, it doesn't have much legality. I was just getting on the Healy icebreaker when that happened, in fact, and it made our mission, which was a relatively obscure scientific mission. And these are, for the most part, these are scientists who are doing the mapping, not these politicians. But the Russians went up there. It was a politician from the Duma, Artur Chilangarov, who went up there and planted a flag right at the seafloor, and that drew a lot of attention, and I think confused the issue as well. It's not quite as contentious, or at least as flag planting as it might seem, though there are a few exceptions. We discussed the Canadian and Danish problem on Hans Island last time.
Well, the Russia itself wasn't planting the flag. This was a privately funded thing by a Russian politician. But hasn't the United States? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you could. By the time the flag was planted, it was certainly a state-affiliated expedition. The origins of it were indeed private. They were, you know, basically an adventure company, an Australian who talked with a bunch of his friends who had access to the Mir submarines. They'd been taking rich people on dives, and they said, you know, we want to go to the true North Pole. We want to go all the way down to the bottom because there's no land at the North Pole. There's only an ice cap. So people have gone to the North Pole. They planted their flag on the sea ice up on top. They've done that for years. But these guys wanted to go to the actual pole on the seafloor, and so they had a website up that you could pay tens of thousands of dollars, and you could sail up there, go in the Mir submersible, dive all the way down there, and plant your flag. And I don't think they had any takers. But then they got the Russian government involved, and they eventually did get Artur Chilangarov, who's the deputy speaker of the Duma, so very close to Putin. And at that point, it did take on a bit of a Russian flavor.
Now, hasn't the United States tried to insist that the North Pole is international territory? Is that because we have the smallest area that we can claim?
Well, indeed, the way these claims work is that the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea sets up a commission. Everyone submits their science, basically saying, look, here's how far our seafloor extends. Here's the scientific basis for this claim, and this is why we would like to claim this as our own. And when Russia did this in 2001, they were in fact the first country in the world to make a claim, and this certainly ruffled some feathers with the Americans, the Danes, and everyone. There was a protest by the U.S. about that claim, and that protest was immediately discarded because the U.S. hasn't signed the Law of the Sea Convention, and so everyone said, what are these guys doing raising a stink when they aren't even part of the treaty?
Well, what about that Law of the Sea Convention, the UN? When they drew it up, did anybody envision something like this situation occurring?
I don't think they did. It was drawn up in the 70s, and the irony, although the U.S. is the main holdout, we are the ones who wrote most of the law.
Now, why have we held out?
We held out basically because of fear by on the right of anything that has the words UN in it. And also fear about these precious metals that could be on the seafloor, and the idea that this convention would, for anything that's outside of the state boundaries, would give these rights to a UN body that would then dole out the money to poor nations. And we said, well, hey, if we don't want the UN to be controlling all these deep sea resources, we want to be able to get them ourselves. And so it was rewritten for the U.S. in mind, and Bush wanted to sign it. Obama seems to be in favor of it, and it's likely we'll eventually go for it. But the oil, I don't think, was part of the, at least wasn't a big part of the thinking, and nor was the Arctic. It was well before the melt started happening. We didn't have good satellite data of the sea ice until 1979, and the melt really accelerated around 2000. So this is a new thing.
My guest is Mackenzie Funk, whose article, Arctic Land Grab, appears in the May issue of National Geographic magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So we know that there's gas and oil up there. Do we know how much?
Well, the official figure is there's, let's say, a quarter of the world's undiscovered oil up there. And that's the one that gets thrown out a lot, and it's very tantalizing. The reality of that is a little bit more complicated, and that's for a few reasons. The first one is that this, in addition to being, perhaps the most oil-rich, untapped area we know of, it's also the least explored. So our basis for saying that it's 25% of the world's untapped oil is basically a desktop study. There have been a few test drillings in the deep Arctic. There's obviously a lot of oil and gas off of Arctic Russia. There's some off of Arctic Norway, Alaska. We've got the North Slope. But as we get into the deep Arctic, almost no one's explored up there. And to say that we know enough about the geology to know how much oil is exactly up there is an overstatement.
But the places you're naming, they're all in the northern parts of those countries. And I wonder if this is all part of the same geological area. Is the petroleum and natural gas in Alaska part of the same sort of thing? Or is that separate?
This is a subject of some debate among geologists as to the origins of the oil and gas up here. And really the formation of the Arctic Ocean is a little bit under debate. But what we do know is that a lot of the, and we're talking hundreds of millions of years, over geological time, a lot of the Arctic plates shifted upward. So there are areas that were in the tropics that have moved up north. So the idea is that a lot of that oil did form at lower latitudes, and then there was tectonic shift, and the plates have moved up such that there's oil up there. You wouldn't imagine that a landscape so dead could have any oil, and that makes sense. But in fact, in the past, it was in a warmer area. And it is, I think a lot of it might come from the same formation. It's a very shallow ocean, and some people think it spread out from the center, that the continents were more locked up there and then it unspun, but I wouldn't want to talk too much about that because it's more complicated than I understand.
Well, has anyone ever tried to speculate about how extraction would work or how much it would cost, and what kind of environmental damage it might cause, because we've had the controversy over the possibility of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and there's real concern about what the impact that would have on the environment.
Well, if you're looking for a recent bit of insanity, there's a plan by Russia that was just unveiled to use nuclear-powered platforms to do drilling in the Russian Arctic offshore.
And, oh boy!
The technology is getting better, and they're able to do deep sea drilling, you know, tens of thousands of feet deep in the Gulf of Mexico. So the idea of offshore drilling is not entirely new, and it's not 100% different, except for the fact that there are going to be icebergs every now and then floating through in the Arctic. We've seen in off of Newfoundland, there are oil rigs there, and they've got the iceberg cowboys. People are out there actually lassoing icebergs and spraying them with water and doing everything they can to keep them away from the icebergs and an iceberg alley there. That's a problem for the Arctic. You know, the sea ice is, though it is melting rapidly, it's there in the wintertime. It's seasonally, you know, still there's going to be a flux. So I think the environmental consequences are the big scare. And there have been fights for every offshore lease that have happened recently. There was a very big one last year, in fact.
How has climate change and the melting of the ice caps affected efforts to map the ocean floor? I'm assuming it's easier now because there's so much more access.
Yeah, you're dead right. It was the main point of shock when we were on the Healy. The scientists who've been up there for 4 years running were thinking that we would have to do some sort of diagonal hash mark pattern. We wouldn't be able to cover all the ground. And then they got up there, and there kept on being no ice. And we kept looking at the satellites thinking, well, there's going to be ice just ahead. But we sailed for 4 or 5 days well beyond those 200 nautical miles that already belonged to the U.S. into the open water, and we kept expecting to hit the ice cap, and we kept not hitting it. And it was probably 4 or 5 days into the cruise before we even hit ice. And once we did, it was thin. You know, we didn't need the 300, 400 foot icebreaker to crunch through this stuff. I think a 20 foot boat could have done it. And that has an enormous effect on mapping. That allows the sonar, which sits at the bottom of the icebreaker, to, first of all, not have all that crunching noise distracting it. It means that the rays from the sonar don't bounce off the particles of ice and then mess it up. And it also means the boat can go a lot faster. In thick ice, we're talking 7-8 meter thick ridges of ice sometimes, and the icebreakers will have to back up, go forward, ram it, back up again, go forward and ram it. And it can be very slow-going for any shipping, let alone mapping, when you need a clear swath of ocean beneath you. In fact, the Danes were up there with a Swedish icebreaker led by a Russian nuclear-powered icebreaker on the other side of the Arctic near Greenland when I was in the Healy. And they invented a new technique called the pirouette. They would go up, break a bunch of ice, and then just spin the boat in a circle, because that seemed to be the best way they could get their data.
Didn't the Healy mission reveal that the U.S. continental slope ends more than 100 nautical miles beyond where it was thought to be?
Revealed is a strong statement, and that was, I think, the scientists were not entirely comfortable with saying for sure that we'd extended the boundaries of the U.S. quite yet. But there was, from the U.S. perspective, a promising bit of data where we can link these undersea mountaintops and undersea ridges together and point to the geological history and say, look, we can extend well past the 80th parallel, not all the way, mind you, to the pole. It's very unlikely that the U.S. will get there. But we did push it a little further that summer, and I think they'll fill in their case a little bit more. You know, that to map all this is incredible. You're looking at these screens. The day-to-day on an icebreaker is dependent on how much you like ice, can be either boring or interesting. But the real excitement was down in the lab, and we're underneath the wet level of the water. We're looking at all these screens, and it just reveals the contours of the seabed as we go forward. So up above the water, you look out, and it's either ice or water for 30 days. And down below, it's this beautiful multicolored map filling in the ups and downs of the mountains, and you're seeing this new landscape revealed really for the first time. And that excitement and the excitement of finding these new seamounts that could perhaps extend the claim was a big part of the fun.
Is this also opening up shipping lanes so that we now will have a Northwest Passage of the sort that explorers the early European explorers imagined they would find?
It is, and I think for the last two summers, the Northwest Passage has been officially navigable for a couple of days.
So are we seeing ships going through them from the east coast of the United States to Asia or to the west coast?
No, we are not, and there are a few reasons for that. The first is that it's very new, and the second one is just the nature of shipping. Things need to be on time. They need to have insurance, and at the moment it is a risky proposition to bet, A, your on-time arrival, and B, your ship itself, that you're going to make it through these ice-covered waters. And I think that's going to be a problem for shipping through the Northwest Passage for a long time. And most experts talk, in fact, about the over-the-top route being as appealing as the Northwest Passage. The way that ice happens to flow in the Arctic is it all clusters in the sort of in the top of North America in the Arctic archipelago. And so as we were up there in the Healy that summer, part of the reason that we may not have seen so much ice wasn't just that it was melting, but that the entire ice cap was shifting, sort of like a cap falling off a bald man's head or something, and shifting and then breaking up into chunks and sitting there in the Canadian archipelago. What you might see well before the Northwest Passage is what's called the Northern Sea Route or the Northeast Passage, and that goes above Russia. Those two routes may be more useful.
This is a story you've been reporting on for years. Has it been getting more attention recently as climate change has become more of a concern for a greater public?
Well, there was nothing like the Russian flag to really gather everyone's attention, and so that seems to have been the high point. The since then, it's been, I think, the vagaries of how much ice is really going to be there for the next, 10 or 15 years. No one's sure exactly how quickly the ice cap is melting, so that's a question of some focus. Certainly the amount of cooperation between the countries has been less sexy than, say, the Russian flag, so that's gotten less attention. And same goes for there have been announcements about the Arctic oil and, of course, about the extinction of the polar bears possibly coming up, and then the nexus of those two things offshore of Alaska. They're very worried about the leases in the Chukchi Sea. So there's some reporting about that, but I would say certainly there needs to be another dramatic flag planting for it to be quite in the public's mind as much as it was.
Arctic Land Grab, Mackenzie Funk's article, which appears in the May issue of National Geographic magazine, has been the subject of our first underreported segment. Thank you so much for being with us today.
All right, thank you.